Yeah, we recorded now. But once again, Roy, thank you so much for just giving me a few minutes of your time. I said off mic, and I'll say it on mic, I have been a fan of your work since day one. I've been rocking with you that, since brother. Birmingham, the Roy Wood Jr. Show. But before that,
Buck Wild Morning Show.
There it is.
Yeah.
And just having you here, I mean, like, just giving it. And we were talking about this off mic too. Like, I listened to you on About last night, and where you talked about grinding when you was doing your thing for your own radio show, as well as going Sullivan's Son, and then doing stand up, and you was piling all of that into it. It was motivation,
man.
I
burned the candle at like three different ends for about 2 years. Now, granted, it ravaged my body, man. I definitely didn't sleep well. Mm-hmm. Like, to give you an idea of my day. So, 2010, I do Last Comic Standing, I get third place.
Yeah.
I've been in LA for about 4 years. Nothing's really popped for me. I'm not booking. I haven't landed a sitcom. I've gotten auditions here and there for guest roles, but I haven't booked shit.
Okay.
So, I get a call from my old program director in Birmingham, and he goes, yo, you know, your shit's hot, things is popping, we're thinking about changing up the morning show. Do you want, you got any interest in coming back to Birmingham? And so my thing to them was, yeah, I would love to come back, but it's got to be a situation where we're building the show for syndication. Because what I essentially wanted, what I was working towards at the time, was basically a southern version of The Breakfast Club.
Okay.
Like what Charlamagne Tha God and mm-hmm. Angela Yee and DJ Envy do. It's very spot on, because you at that time YouTube was starting to pop. So, well, YouTube's already popping, but
it wasn't nowhere near where it was
with
now.
Terrestrial radio did not have that presence like that. And
it was dying off. Everyone went to satellite and regular radio, terrestrial radio.
Streaming killed a lot of terrestrial radio.
Exactly.
So
it was no more personality based.
And then internet and cars is also something else that changed everything. So, but basically my program director agrees to that. He goes, all right, cool. You can do the show how you want to do the show, but you got to do the show from Birmingham. I go, all right, bet. Okay. So I move back home. Before I go home, I do one last audition for a show on TBS called Sullivan and Son. And I do the audition, and I get the role. But I don't find out. I audition like August.
Okay.
We shoot the pilot in November. So that's just like an off one day in November. I'm doing my radio show. I'm a resident of Birmingham. I'm touring and doing comedy on the weekends. So I'm just a radio DJ and a comedian again, you know?
Yeah.
Get the call from the network in December that the show got picked up and we're going to shoot 12 episodes. So we shoot 12 episodes in Los Angeles over the course of maybe, I don't know, 3 months.
Okay.
We shoot 10 episodes over the course of 3 months. And so that required me to be in Los Angeles for 3 straight months. So you're doing a morning show.
You got
to
be there
from Alabama. So they give me a satellite box. And so it's kind of like it's a little less of an ISDN line. Mm. And the technology back then wasn't as tight as it is now. Sometimes I was on a 2-second delay from the rest of the people in the room. So we had to, we were doing live radio and I'm on a 2-second delay.
Yeah, you can't be quick.
It's very, yeah, and comedy is very timed.
Time based.
So it was a learning curve for us and we got over it. And I had a really good team, man. Had a really good team that really helped make that work, because it was very atypical the way we were doing a local radio show with the host in LA. Now, mind you, our show goes on the air at 6 a.m. That's 4 a.m. in Los Angeles, which means I need to be up at 3 a.m. to do my show prep. So you get up at 3 a.m., you wash your ass and brush your teeth, go get some food from somewhere. I'm staying in a hotel in Burbank, mind you, when I'm doing this. So, you know, 3:30, you know, around 3:30 in the morning, you start reading all your articles, your media takeouts, and you make your rounds, the YBFs and all of that. and start figuring out what the show is going to be today. You do the show from 4 a.m. to 8 a.m., which is 10 a.m. Birmingham time. Then there's another hour of post-show wrap-up stuff.
Right.
9 a.m. is time to be on set to do rehearsals. There were times that I was doing the last break of my show in my car on my way to set.
That's crazy.
Where you literally can hear cars zooming by and hear the rumble of the road. And I'm doing radio in Alabama from an intersection in Burbank. And you do rehearsal from 9 to 3 or 9 to 5 or something like that. Mm-hmm. Rewrites and all of that. You get a quick little 2-3 hour break. You're in L.A. You got to get on stage. Not every night, but 3-4 nights out of the week. You need to be in these comedy clubs staying sharp.
Right.
Because you're about to be on a sitcom, which means you'll get the tour off of that, which means you need to have good jokes. So I'm in the comedy clubs from 8 p.m. until 11 p.m. Sometimes as late as midnight. I get back to the hotel. I sleep for 3 hours.
Yeah, I'm doing the math now. Like, wait, that's 2-3 hours. Then you got to do it again.
And I'm back up at 3 a.m. Wash, rinse, repeat. I did that for 3 months. We shot the show. I went back to Birmingham, continued the morning show. And then going into the next year, the show gets picked up for season 2. And then they're adding a comedy tour on the back end.
Yeah.
So now I got to be gone 6 months. So I make the decision that I'm going to move back to L.A. and do Birmingham from L.A. And that was pretty much the poison pill that killed the Roy Wood Jr. show. Because corporate didn't want... And, you know, I have a lot of mixed feelings about it, but I know that ultimately they had to make a business decision, and so did I.
I mean, I get
it. We're still friends to this day. There's no beef with any of the people involved.
Yeah, it's just like, just timing. The timing of the whole thing.
It was very disappointing because I know what we could have been. I know what that show could have been, and I know that it was not given a fair enough chance. Because, you know, you look at what the Breakfast Club, half those interviews that go viral on the Breakfast Club don't even air on the fucking show, man. It's just internet juice. They know how to feed people. And that's what you have to do. You have to produce. You have to put money into it.
Yeah.
It just didn't work out. So, you know, that was pretty much the end of my run in radio on a regular basis. I still contribute in Atlanta over at Kiss 104 with my man Art Terrell.
Mm-hmm.
And that's lovely, but it's nothing like the Birmingham days, man.
But if it helps, and I'm silver lining this whole thing. Let's fast forward to now. Things are starting to.
Of course. I mean, I wouldn't make that decision again.
Oh, okay.
I don't.
All right. I want to make.
I'm on a TV show, and they're going to put me on a tour. Comedy Greater Sign Radio.
Yeah.
Especially terrestrial radio, that at a time. You're not giving me the budget I need to even build the show into something syndicated, because that's what I wanted to do.
You never really got that fair shake.
Of course not, because we needed the numbers locally.
Mm-hmm.
And to get numbers locally, you got to be present in the market as the host. You got to be out shaking hands, kissing babies. You can't be in Burbank on a studio lot reading scripts. So for that part of it, that's part of what stymied the show's progress.
I get it.
In the beginning. So... it's like you can't do both. You just can't. So, you know, creatively, though, the thing that I'll always credit Birmingham with from day one when I fucking got on the air in 2001, man, Birmingham never restricted me creatively as a comedian.
Word.
And I came into that radio market following Ricky Smiley. So I kind of had to be different because Ricky...
he got his own flavor.
Still is,
yeah.
To this day. Ricky is the king of Birmingham.
Yeah.
He always will be. And my city loved me. My city got hella respect for me and mm-hmm. vice versa. But Ricky was first. Ricky's the king. And he left a comedic imprint so huge that the only thing you could do to try and stand out is to do everything he didn't do. So I started figuring out real fast, all right, he didn't do a lot of radio sketches, so I'm going to do radio sketches. I'm going to have call-in characters. I'm going to have, like, I started looking at the way Howard Stern did his shit with, like, Baba Booey and Beetlejuice.
Right,
like,
right.
Stern is a cast of characters. Like, when he was...
yeah, when he was Stern.
Before he went to Satellite.
Yeah, you had it. there all these then when they brought people. In the producers, correct. And you brought in, you got the chance to know those characters and kind of sort of identify.
Correct. And I mean, and to be able to do the type of shit we did on the air in urban radio, which is such a predictable and creatively stale place. It is most urban radio morning shows on the local level are creatively stale. And they all do the same
thing. Yeah.
And so I had these bosses that would let me. I had to do some of the fuck shit that they wanted to do. And that's fine. And I did it. But the give and the get was always you could do this other thing that you wanted to do. Some of the sketches that I do now online and some of the stuff that I've even pitched at the Daily Show was originated on the radio in Birmingham.
Is it sort of like you get a chance, I guess a second chance, because you didn't...
I got all these unburned ideas.
Yeah, unburned ideas, as you didn't see. By the way, you killing it. I have to say it on the Daily Show. And most importantly, as a father, congratulations.
Well,
welcome to
you,
the
sir.
Club.
Oh, God.
Israel
brothers always be wanting you to be happy. Well, oh, yeah, welcome to the club. Now we can all drink beers.
I mean, it is what it is.
Yeah. It's good, man. It's good. It's not always the most convenient thing, fatherhood.
Because, yeah.
And not on a logistical sense, but on a mental sense. Because I have to spend real estate now worrying about another person. And that's the first time I've ever had to do that. And it's not till you have a kid that you realize how bullshit, like...
The trip.
School and like, oh, you need an egg baby. We're going to simulate parenthood. No, you're not. You can't simulate worrying.
No,
like, I can't be in the same room with my kid without him in my peripheral at all times to make sure he's not trying to murder himself.
And
he's
10
months.
That's let me know. You the man for the job, because me and my wife, when we found out we was about to have a kid, we did all the books and the stuff like that. And then, I think like 3 weeks into it, we just dropped it. It was like, this is, you never going to know until you're just in it.
Yep.
And when you get in it.
I'll start listening to all these podcasts and all this nonsense.
What am I doing? Because I tried to be like what is called a quote unquote A-plus dad, where you get all of the new tools and all of the books and all of the stuff. And I was like, I'm going to be it. And then I went back to thinking about my dad. Who essentially just had common sense in a beer. Essentially. Yeah. That's just what it was. And I sort of turned out okay. I feel okay. My brothers, we good. And I noticed sometimes that common sense level have to come out. Also, saw our special father figure.
Thank you, sir.
And it was like a wake-up call. I was like, oh, man, this guy gets it. I want to ask this question since I got you in the room. You said that special was what you want to say to your child
when he's old enough.
When he's old enough to get it, but my question was, you could just tell him, right?
That's under the assumption I'm still alive.
All right. Yeah, we stay in Trump America. Sorry. Yeah. You're right. Good call.
I mean, man. Most of my existence is built around assuming I won't be here to tell him everything he needs to know.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I didn't really have a sense of mortality until I had a kid. And it's like, oh, shit. I'm going to die first. All right. Well, let me start putting together
whatever, a game plan.
Let me give him a how-to kit for life, basically. And so that's where a lot of this stuff comes from. And, hopefully I'm old enough and live long enough to be able to straighten them out,
Yeah.
But if I'm not, just in case.
You got a fail safe.
He's got that. You can go watch it.
Yeah.
And so give him a couple drops in the bucket about race and America and how to navigate stuff and how to look at things. And the only thing that I think would make that special irrelevant 20 years from now is if racism ends. If that's the case, then what no lesson to teach him anyway.
There you go. But one cool thing, I guess, I like how you said that, like, if you're not around, because it's a different form of thinking. When my little boy was born, I went the other way. I was like, oh my God, I can't die. I was like, oh my God, I gotta stick around for little man. If anything, I gotta stick around so he could go up. Because I was like, it's a lot of dudes. It was like, it's not like any like real men to teach them stuff now.
Yeah.
Mainly because I get a healthy diet at the NBA and I'm watching the league, and I was like, if they can do this to basketball, the skinny jeansification of the league.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying.
And so I'm just like, I got to be around to let him know what the deal is.
Yeah, I figure, I think about that, and people go, oh, don't you want to eat healthy for your child? Yeah, I'm trying. I haven't nailed it, but you get insurance in case you die. You get health insurance in case you get fucked up. So here's some advice insurance. That's how I look at it.
That's what's up.
So, you know, I also need to, like, make videos, like, directly to him. But I don't know if that'll creep him out. It'd be morbid to just have your father on some video from 20 years ago.
It's a good move. That, honestly, my son's birth was one of the things that continued me to podcast. Because I wanted to let him know, okay, look, this is all, every time we tape, like right now, it's a timestamp. This is where we are in life right now.
Yeah.
And this is what's going on. We're going to kick in some special guests like my man Roy Wood Jr. to make sure your dad wasn't sitting in a room talking to himself. Yeah. He had, you know, he had a little swagger about himself. But for the most part, here's a timestamp if I'm not around.
You can go back and listen to that stuff. And he will at some point.
There you go. Because I had to do that with my parents. Because I didn't realize my dad and my mom was cool until I went to college. And then, like, they were just like, well, you out of the house now. We can tell you the time your dad punched the cop. Like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Where was this story? Oh, this is the time your dad wrestled a bear. That really happened? You know, like, little dumb shit like that.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, I could have used that during my growing up. I could have used a cool story. My dad was just a guy who watched Law and Order on the couch, and my mom would come in, and that was my mental picture of him. But now that I know all this cool stuff, it was cool. It was like Purple Rain. Remember in the movie Purple Rain when he goes in the basement to open the truck and realizes his dad was like one of the greatest piano players ever? That was my dad punched a cop story.
I've always thought about, I read Bernie Mac's book, his autobiography, before he passed. I don't remember the title of it, but it was a good book. And he talks about raising his daughter a lot in the book and how he's not her friend and how he's not supposed to be her friend. It's
my
job to be your friend. And that just is the only thing that stuck with me about fatherhood in terms of like a book on fatherhood and how to be. It's the only book out there about how to be a comedian while raising a child and being on the road. Now, granted, Bernie had his daughter before he became a blowout success. So he was home a lot more on the front end than I have the opportunity to be sometimes. But that part of it definitely resonates. Probably the best fatherhood manual for a comedian is probably Bernie Mac's autobiography. Maybe You Never Cry Again. That's the name of it.
Yep. I have that book. And I think one of the things that stuck out to me, the fact that he wasn't famous yet. And he was doing them shows on Chicago, the train. He was doing it on the L train. And the fact that he had that in the back of his head pushed him and propelled him to go further.
Yeah, so
it's all about perspectives, I guess.
I have zero interest in being my son's friend. My only job is to prepare him for the horrors of the world. And I'll let his mom give him all the balance of positivity and hugs. And kisses,
but We got that coin flip too. I am disciplined. I am teaching. I am whatever. And she's like happy-go-lucky. Hey, let's hang out. I'm like, if you with me and I'm doing some cool shit, I'm not going to exclude you. But I mean, like, and lastly, I want to thank you for giving me a little bit of time.
Oh, it's all good.
I got one last question, and I want to kind of focus on the Daily Show. Because, I mean, I asked about your stand-up. I asked about your home life and the special. I got to ask about the Daily Show.
Okay.
You do a lot of cool stuff as far as, like, the correspondent pieces. And you go off into different stuff. And I'm always curious. Are the people in on the joke? Or is it a thing where you may be scared, or you may be, you do something where they didn't put you out there so much where you got to keep, you know what I mean? You got to keep the bit going, but at the same time.
The thing you have to remember with anyone that we interview for the show, these are real stories. Mm-hmm. So these are real people who have real opinions. Their opinion might be outrageous. Their feelings on the issue might be outrageous. But there's nothing to put on. Like, I did a story about the gun emoji. And so Apple succumbed. So gun right activists protested to Apple to get rid of the gun emoji on the iPhone with the new iOS update.
I remember it, seeing it.
So the gun has been replaced with a water pistol. And so I sat down with the lady that is with the group that lobbied for this. And so I sat and I talked with this lady, and she goes, well, you don't need a gun emoji. It's not violent. It's violence. It's like nobody's getting murdered with an emoji. Then we went and talked with the chick who said that her rights are being violated because Apple did this. And she's angry and she's outraged that Apple would dare. And they're both ridiculous positions. But I think what we really try to do, because it's not a bit in terms of, I'm going to get you and I'm going to make you say something goofy.
Right.
I'm just rolling. It's punch and counterpunch. So if you say something that's a little off the wall, I'm going to ask you to elaborate, or I'm going to ask you to expand on that. You know, we had a guy that was against, we had a guy in Texas, the Cox Not Glocks piece, if you want to Google it.
Yeah, that was that the one about the dildos? And correct. Yeah.
You can bring a gun. The law in Texas states that you can bring a concealed weapon on a college campus, but you cannot bring a dildo. So which one is more dangerous, a cock or a Glock?
The gun, obviously. Okay.
So we talked to a guy that is pro-gun, anti-dildo. That is his legitimate
position. It seems absurd when you say it, yeah.
But that's his reality. So I sit down with you and I talk to you in your reality. To the rest of the people on the outside, yeah, this dude is, this is wacky. But I don't have to play that up. It's already, you already know how it's going to come across to most people because most people don't agree with him. But you still sit and talk to the man and you give him fair space to state his case and make his opinion, because it's not about putting these people up on display for us to all laugh at. It's it's legit journalism, man. It's legit. Why do you feel this way? Well, what if I offered you this instead? What if I offered you this instead? Would you be willing to hold a dildo? Would you be like, it's just goofy questions, but they're all rooted in this reality. Yeah. So these people that we do bits with, that we do segments with, we honor their point of view. And then it's not until post-production and edit that some of them feel like, okay, maybe I shouldn't have said that. Or maybe
okay,
I shouldn't have done that.
Okay, I get it now. Because sometimes when you watch it, it's like the viewer at home, you're like, you really didn't think this through. Like when you see those wacky point of views, it's like, hey, what point was you on the... Because I try to look at both sides of every story. Mm-hmm. I see. And I'm like, at what point was this even a good idea? Because I remember the Cox versus Glocks thing. I'm like, why was that such a bad thing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
People are insane. So, you know, with the pieces that we do, we try to always make sure that you're honoring that person's opinion, because you know, some pieces, some segments, we don't talk to both sides. We focus only on one person. Jordan Klepper did that once where he spoke with a pastor that supports Donald Trump, but this pastor has all of his own issues and backstory, and Jordan just sat with the guy and let him talk and explain himself and basically kept coming back and countering this guy's statements and, you know, his opinions. Well, I think Trump is this, even though he did that. Well, I have not read about that, but I will go read up on that, and then I will have an opinion. So it's just that, but that's just a journalistic back and forth.
You just asking questions to a very interesting subject.
Correct. Who happens to believe that Hillary Clinton might be the devil or whatever. Like, there's always somebody who has a weird, wacky opinion. But, so, you know, there's no need to vilify people for it. It's just...
Oh, I never thought it was, yeah, a vilified thing, but there is that vibe of, he didn't just say that, did he?
Oh, they did.
Yeah, you know what I
mean? Oh, yeah.
But once again, I want to thank you for just giving me a little bit of your time.
Not a problem.
Anytime you welcome, you come on the podcast. Everyone who's listening, RedwoodJr.com, please see my man. Actually, I didn't say this up front, but this is after his comedy show at Mark Ridley's, and he ripped it, and I'm pretty sure he'll do that wherever he's going next. Wherever you see him, check my man out.
I got to tighten up these Trump jokes.
Well, you may not have to. You probably got, I don't know. My clock is 2 years.
Yeah, we'll see.
My clock says 2 years. We'll I don't see. Think he's making a whole four. But thanks again.
It'll be a struggle. All right, brother.
All right.